Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jean Todd. I'm with the Suffolk Public Defender's Office, and this morning I represent the appellant Gerald Wood. This case is a construction fraud case. Mr. Wood was convicted of violating 18.2200.1. The issues in the case is whether or not the evidence of prior conviction should have been admitted, and as a result, whether or not the Commonwealth was able to prove the matter against Mr. Wood beyond a reasonable doubt. The Commonwealth argues that...
Well, counsel, let's just go right to the heart of the matter, perhaps. And, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with the Hackney case from this court. And in reference to, of course, the holding of the Hackney case was that you could use, based upon, to prove a relevant element of the case, such as motive, intent, common scheme, plan, or identity. And how does that affect this case?
Well, I'd point out that the court relied on Mughrabi. Mm-hmm. In finding that the evidence should be admitted at the behest of the Commonwealth, and Mughrabi was significantly different than the case at bar, because in Mughrabi and in a number of other cases like Mughrabi, many of the incidents of the prior bad acts were proved at trial by evidence or documentation. Here, mere prior convictions were used to prove an element of the offense, be it intent or any other element of the of the matter. In this case,
they weren't just prior convictions. They were convictions of activity that occurred on dates extremely close to the date that this occurred, when he accepted the check from the Todds, right?
Yes, sir.
So why aren't they very relevant, given that his contractor's license had been revoked in June before those convictions happened, I guess, in April and May, and then this happened in May, right?
Well, one thing, we don't know, because all that was provided to the court were the prior convictions. What the framework, the time framework was. We don't know when the date of offenses were. We have some sense that the court had some sense that they were occurring around the same time, but we don't have any sense of what they were in sum. And the court spoke to the fact that they were construction fraud cases and thus had to be similar to the activity that Mr. Wood was charged with, but we don't know that because there was no evidence of any of the other cases other than the convictions. And I would point out that the principle against admitting prior convictions in a particular case is one that should be thoughtfully considered before they are used, because if in this case, where there are no evidence of the facts underlying the prior conviction, simply because they are a violation of the same statute, would apply. And if that was upheld, then one could point to other types of crimes, such as plain larceny or plain forgery, and say that simply because an act occurred around the same period of time and the person was convicted of it, then they can be used as well against the individual who's being charged in the present case with a particular violation of law. And here, too, by accepting the fact that just the prior convictions are a legitimate proof of intent, would be to go so far as to say that anyone who has a conviction for a prior act around the same time or of the same violation of statute without more is making Rule 2404 practically null, of no importance. And there have been many cases, especially in the construction fraud case, where the courts have had trouble deciding what kind of activity is sufficient, what kind of prior activity is sufficient to prove prior bad acts. And the large majority of them have some element other than simply the conviction to show that they form a pattern of behavior or a common scheme or plan. In this case, without that, those factual elements present, we have alleged that it's error for the trial court to hold that those prior bad acts should be admitted, or those prior convictions should be admitted to prove the intent of the individual to commit the crime at bar.
Counsel, I understand your argument, but then if you move on ultimately to the specific facts in this case, on May the 18th, when the negotiation occurred and the money was delivered by the victim to your client, during that period of time, as Judge Beals indicated, in June of 2013, he had already, his license had been revoked. So he was operating outside of the law on when he accepted the money to repair the roofing of the house, of the victim's house, on May the 18th. Doesn't that have some inference of what his intent could be?
I don't disagree with that. However, in looking at whether or not the Commonwealth has proved beyond a reasonable doubt whether the individual has actually violated the act, they had to look at the time that the money was accepted, whether or not he had the intent to defraud. And simply because he didn't have a license is not dispositive of whether or not he intended to not complete the work or defraud. And in this particular case, the argument against finding that one element alone was sufficient to prove the case against Mr. Wood is that he maintained communication with the Todds throughout the period, and they're not related to me, throughout the time that the matter was pending. He
up until the time he got into jail, and even then he had communication from jail.
Exactly.
Is that correct?
Yes. At the time that he received the money, there was all indication that he was a legitimate businessman, and the Todds did research to determine whether or not he was a legitimate businessman before they entered into the contract and gave him their money. There were excuses during the period of time that he wasn't able to order the supplies, or the supplies were ordered improperly, or something along that line. And it wasn't until he was actually arrested and unable to return the advance that he that there appeared to be a significant problem. And another incidence of the matter is that Mr. Todd didn't want Mr. Wood to be there while he wasn't there. And when he testified, Mr. Todd indicated that, in fact, there were many times when he wasn't going to be able to be there and Mr. Wood couldn't have done the work anyway. So there were, explainable...
But how do you explain the situation with the check and his statements? Well, the bank is, an out-of-state bank, so they're going to hold it, but of course it was Wells Fargo in Virginia, and other statements about the bank, the bank hasn't allowed me to get the funds yet, and yet he had deposited the check a good while ago. And
I admit that's odd. However, it was done by text, so one could believe that he might have been talking to somebody else when those texts were occurring. I mean, it just kind of, it's odd in the sense that he's talking with somebody who had given him a check in May and who should have known, why he didn't know, I don't know, but he should have known that the check had already been deposited, and yet they're talking about some bank in Ohio. It just, it's like out in left field. It didn't seem like it belonged.
The check cleared in 3 days, I think, according to the evidence.
Right.
Is that correct?
Right. The the admission of the prior convictions has to be determined to be, in this particular case, determined to be more prejudicial than probative of the events, because When the court considers evidence as a whole and under the standard of review that this court looks at the case, we consider the whole, all of the evidence in making a determination as to whether the evidence was sufficient. And in this case, the fact of the prior convictions being admitted can only lead to a conclusion that that piece of evidence was substantially was substantial in causing the court to conclude that there was intent to defraud in this particular instance. And without it, I think the court would have to consider that without that evidence, was it proved beyond a reasonable doubt whether or not Mr. Wood committed the offense? And I suggested to the court that it wasn't, that there are too many explanations either side as to how these events progressed from May through October. And because there's an equal balance in the explanation that can be made with respect to how this event rolled out, that without that evidence of prior bad acts, Mr. Wood could not have been found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Thank you, Ms. Todd. You have your remaining time for rebuttal. Ms. Johnson, good morning.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Victoria Johnson. I'm here for the Commonwealth. This conviction should be affirmed because the court did not err when it admitted the sentencing orders, or pardon me, the certified conviction orders, and the evidence of intent was sufficient. To start with the certified conviction orders, the court found that they were probative because they recited similar acts within weeks of this act. The offense dates are set forth on the certified conviction orders, and that's at Appendix 102 and 104. The Norfolk offense date was April 23rd of 14, and the Chesapeake offense date was May 8th of 14. And, of course, the contract was entered in this case on May 18th, and the advance was paid on May 18th. So these were temporarily very close together. And the court found that this went to a pattern and was probative of the defendant's state of mind and of his intent. And this is very similar to the findings that were made in the McGrawby case. Now, it's true that in McGrawby, there was more evidence. You know, we had live testimony of people talking about how the defendant had entered into contracts with them, and we had a state investigator in McGrawby talking about the number of complaints that he had dealt with and how he had talked to the defendant in McGrawby specifically about how he needed to return advances that he had paid out, and the defendant just flat refused to do it in McGrawby. However, that doesn't necessarily go to admissibility. That more goes to weight. There was just more to consider in McGrawby. And I submit that would also go towards prejudice. Here, the bare conviction orders were a little less prejudicial as well. So I think that the court properly admitted that evidence. I also point out to the court that when intent is at issue, the case law says that the court has broad discretion in allowing evidence of intent, and that's cited in our brief. Furthermore, the court really put a lot of emphasis on the fact that the defendant was, when the court made its findings, the court put a lot of emphasis on the fact that the defendant did not have a license at the time and was holding himself out as a legitimate businessman. The witness from the State Licensure Board testified at Appendix 16 that a person engaged in this kind of business doing this kind of roofing work would be required to have a contractor's license to do this kind of roof replacement, and yet the defendant was holding himself out as a legitimate businessman to induce people into these contracts. And while the defendant did maintain communication, he was maintaining communication by making false statements. And whether those statements were false to the victims here or whether they were, you know, some kind of mistaken identity text, that was a matter for the fact finder. And the fact finder rejected that theory and concluded that these were false statements that the defendant made to kind of continue to string along this fraud. And, you know, to kind of deceive Mr. Todd, who did not reconcile the family checkbook and who just did not really know what was going on with the checking account. And the trial court found that that was, you know, something that is a reality of family life. You know, sometimes one partner maintains the checkbook and another one doesn't. And that was perfectly possible. And so we have the defendant saying at first that supplies weren't ordered, and then saying, well, the check was made out wrong, so I have to deposit it now in a different way, and then, well, the check isn't going to clear because I deposited it late, and all the while it had deposited 3 months earlier. So those were certainly things that the trial court could take into consideration. McGrawby noted, again, the McGrawby case noted that statements made later could be used to infer intent at the time the advance was taken, that intent to defraud. And the trial court properly relied on that as well. So given all that evidence in the record, you know, and the fact that, you know, there's no evidence any supplies were ever ordered, there was never a nail driven, there was never a shingle laid, there were no supplies delivered to this home.
Ms. Johnson, what do you say to Ms. Todd's point that Mr. Todd said, I want to be here when you do it, which is perfectly understandable. Somebody's working on his house, putting a roof or whatever on. He wants to be there when the work's sure. being done. But there were a lot of days he couldn't be there.
I think that, you know, standing alone, I think that could be a reasonable defense to a scheduling difficulty. But here we have someone, again, looking at the totality of the circumstances, we have someone who didn't have a contractor's license that was holding himself out, again, as a legitimate businessman. And we have these false statements about the check. And I think that when we take those into consideration, you know, if there was some kind of legitimate scheduling difficulty, I think that pales in comparison with the rest of the evidence.
Whether he could do the job at all.
And, you know, whether Mr. Todd was there or not, supplies still could have been delivered to the house. You know, the shingles could have been delivered. So there were just no steps taken to fulfill the contract at all over this period. And I think the trial court put a lot of emphasis on these kind of false statements about the check and that no steps were taken towards completion. So I think that those things in the record, that kind of undercuts the notion that there was a legitimate scheduling difficulty rather than just an inability to complete the job at all while holding oneself out as being able to do it and taking that significant amount of money, that $3,100, cashing the check within 2 days, and then taking no steps towards completion. And I think that was the evidence before the court, and I submit that is sufficient evidence to support the conviction. The trial court's finding wasn't plainly wrong or without evidence to support it, and we'd ask that you'd affirm. If there's more questions, of course, I'm happy to answer them. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Ms. Todd, you have your rebuttal time.
The Commonwealth has relied on false statements made by a defendant to the Todds. However, there's been no evidence at trial to show that any statements that Mr. Wood made were false. There was no, he said that he had difficulty ordering the materials from suppliers. He said that he, when contacted by the Todds, he said he would either return the deposit or return the materials that he had in his building. There was no evidence to dispute the fact that they were actually facts. I would also point out, and while this is, I'm not sure how much weight the court would give to this, but in the sentencing, and while it doesn't indicate a sense that the court did not find Mr. Wood guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, because of course he did, but in his sentencing, he did say that oftentimes people get into this situation when they are contractors, that they end up robbing Peter to pay Paul in order to make one customer happy, and at some point they have difficulty resolving those issues, and it ends up in a situation like this. And I believe the case of, I believe it was Klink, that actually emphasized that type of activity, wherein the court indicated that the contractors, when they get in trouble and they can't meet their obligations, and they try to resolve the situation by telling the customer that they'll do it in 2 weeks or a week, is not, the court found in that case that it wasn't sufficient for a finding of guilt, that those are business-related problems that happen, and that they are explained that way, and without an explanation that shows that they actually had criminal intent at the time that they entered in, or that the time that they received the advance, is insufficient to show that, in fact, the person at the time that they accepted the advance had the intent to deprive the individuals of their hard-earned money. And I would submit that this is that case. This is a case where Mr. Wood apparently got himself in trouble. He tried to resolve it in a way that wasn't satisfactory to the Todds. The Todds ended up prosecuting him for construction fraud, but that does not mean that Mr. Wood, at the time that he accepted the advance, intended to deprive the Todds of their money.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Todd.